This week, we sling over our shoulders a piece of technology that needs little introduction. An object which turned those who played it into semi-mythical figures. An instrument that came to symbolise 20th century pop culture, but which is now struggling to make itself heard amidst the digital noise of the internet age. I'm Nick Mason. I play the drums in Pink Floyd. You're listening to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. Today, we are isolating in the mix the electric guitar. For over 50 years, I've sat in one of the best seats in the House of Rock History and watched innumerable air guitarists replicate the fingering of David Gilmour's guitar solos. But where exactly did the electric guitar come from? Plucked string instruments have been around in some shape or form for thousands of years. The guitar itself is widely believed to have emerged in 14th century Spain. But six centuries later, and with the advent of electricity, a new sound emerged from a Hawaiian paradise.
Hawaiian music was immensely popular in America in the early parts of the 20th century.
Brad Tolinsky is the co-author of Play It Loud, A History of the Electric Guitar.
There were these Broadway shows that celebrated and romanticized this version of Hawaiian culture, and there were hit songs like My Waikiki Mermaid and films like The Hula in 1927, and lap steel guitars, or guitars that were played horizontally, played a large role in that music and had a lot to do with bringing guitar into focus in the United States and for American culture.
And there was a Texan called George Beauchamp who was determined to make his guitar louder. Beauchamp's initial idea was to create one out of metal instead of wood, what he called a steel resonator guitar. But there was a problem with hollow-bodied acoustic guitars and amplification.
Most people try to simply put a microphone in front of the acoustic guitar, but when it was turned up, it created feedback. So Beauchamp tried to amplify the vibration of the string using parts from a phonograph, and he built the first electromagnetic pickup and put it in this guitar called the frying pan. It was called the frying pan because that's exactly what it looked like, a frying pan. First public performance of the frying pan was in, of all places, Wichita, Kansas, on Halloween night in 1932, and it was a performance by a fellow named Gage Brewer. People in that era were sort of genuinely in awe of electricity. I mean, they did it on Halloween night. They knew that it would appear to be some sort of spooky, mysterious force creating the sound, and actually, the Electro String Instrument Corporation, the people that made the frying pan, had no problem promoting the instrument as something otherworldly. Their slogan was, "Brother musicians, listen to a miracle."
The frying pan can be seen in a museum in New York, but similar guitars from the same era are still in use today. This is British guitarist Richard Hawley, owner of a Selma lap steel.
I've used the Selma on pretty much every session since I was a teenager. To look at it, it's the most unglamorous instrument. It's just a wooden plank. You have to play it with a bar. But the sound of it is incredibly rich. Like, it sounds like what I would imagine angels sound like to me. You know?
But did the instrument we know today really evolve from Hawaiian lap steel guitars? The owner of one of the most respected guitar makers in the United States, Paul Reed Smith, begs to differ. He believes a sound engineer, Lloyd Law, developed an electric harp guitar in 1923.
I saw a harp guitar that had a pickup that was a foot and a half long and 2 inches square that pulled out of the harp guitar. The jack on it was the headlight jack from a Model T Ford because they hadn't invented an input jack yet. And in my opinion, he did the first one that I've ever seen, and I was stunned when I saw it. And that is not the way the history books are, but that was in the 20s. As the story goes, he tried to convince the company that he worked for at the time to go into the electric guitar business, and they weren't interested. Now, he's ahead of his time.
And who did Lloyd Law work for? The Gibson Guitar Company. One of the giants in this story is undoubtedly Gibson Guitars. Starting out in 1902, Gibson was in the business of making finely crafted acoustic instruments. But eventually, Gibson realized the race for loudness was very much on, and in 1936, they released the ES-150. The instrument created a clear sound which suited the jazz and swing music of the era, and so the time had come for the first electric guitar hero. Who the hell wants to hear an electric guitar player? The American bandleader Benny Goodman famously grumbled, before he had heard Charlie Christian.
And now the new group in the band, the Sextet, and our new discovery, Charles Christian at the electric guitar. Charlie's from Oklahoma, and Charlie, I really think, is one of the most terrific musicians who's been produced in years.
With his distinctive technique, it was a black man in a racially segregated America who helped the electric guitar break out of the rhythm section and take center stage.
After Goodman heard him play, you know, Christian's talent was just too monumental for Goodman to ignore. People heard this on the radio and just flipped, and they couldn't see whether he was white or whether he was black. The effect that it had on the electric guitar was as if the Beatles had brought an accordion player into their band. It would have made accordion sales go berserk overnight.
But the one man who would become synonymous with the Gibson brand was more than just a virtuosic guitar player.
Here are Les Paul and his wife, Mary Ford, returning home from a Hollywood premiere to tell you about how they make Capitol Records right at home. They did the multiple recording of 10 guitars and 12 voices for How High the Moon at home here in Hollywood and keep recorders in their New York apartment and even in their car.
Today, you might be forgiven for thinking Les Paul was just the brand name of one of the most famous guitars in the world. But Les Paul, the man, was much more than that. During the 1950s, along with his wife Mary Ford, he sold millions of records and hosted hugely popular television and radio shows in the US. Music historian David Hepworth.
Les Paul's a really key figure in that he spots early on one of the things that made the electric guitar so powerful is that you could make it sound not like a guitar. Les Paul has started to make it sound kind of space age. It seemed to come from another dimension.
As well as being an accomplished guitarist, Les Paul was also a keen inventor. He was a whiz in the studio and pioneered several recording techniques. He's also often credited, rightly or wrongly, with inventing the electric guitar. Still a teenager, Les Paul fashioned an electric instrument out of a piece of railroad track, a guitar string, and the mic from his mother's telephone. Here's Les talking to the Audio Engineering Society in 2002.
I ran to my mother and I said, Mom, I've got it. She says, you solved the problem? Yep. I says, it's this piece of railroad track I got. And my mother says, the day you see a cowboy on a horse with a piece of railroad track, right? And where are you gonna plug it in? Oh boy, did she shoot me down.
Several years later, Les Paul revisited the idea of his railroad guitar to create what he christened The Log.
And this time I took a 4x4 piece of wood, put a neck on it, and when I got it all built, this was in New York in 1941, and I put the thing together, and I went to Gladys's, was the name of the little tavern, and I went in there and I played with a group this 4x4 log. And they looked at me like I was nuts. There was no applause. And so I went home So I thought about it, and I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put some sides on it like a regular guitar. So I made the two sides for the guitar, clamped them on to the 4x4 log, went back on a Saturday night, same place, played the same song, and the place went crazy. So I said, well, I guess the secret to that is that people hear with their eyes. If it don't look good, it don't sound good. I guess that's what it is.
Les was so sure his log would strike the right chord, he contacted Gibson. But executives at the company mocked what they called a broomstick with pickups. It would take 10 years before Les, this time a big star on TV and radio, to hear from Gibson again. One day, he got a phone call from an engineer called Ted McCarty, who would help cement Les Paul's name in rock and roll history.
He was famous for the one thing that he didn't invent, which was the Les Paul guitar. That was created primarily by Ted McCarty, an inventor and engineer at Gibson Guitars, who spearheaded the design and used Les to market it.
I'm back, honey.
Hi. You know, I tied this string around my finger to remember to tell you something when you got back from shopping. I forgot what it was.
Oh, not again. Well, let's do The World's Waiting for the Sunrise while you try and think of it.
But in 1951, why were Gibson so interested in developing a mass-produced electric guitar? Only a year earlier, a Californian radio repairman called Leo Fender had released the Telecaster.
With its modular design, the Telecaster was the first guitar that could be put together on an assembly line. In that way, it's been compared to the Model T. That's what we call it. The Telecaster is the Model T of the guitar. It was counter to the idea of Gibson's finely crafted tradition.
Guitarist Jim Peterick.
When Leo Fender invented the Telecaster, it was like a farm implement. It was just very crude, very basic, and you could plow a field or play a guitar. It was affordable. He wanted it to be for the working class person.
By the mid-1950s, the guitar wars were in full swing. And with the Fender Telecaster on one side and the Gibson Les Paul on the other, the battle was being fought by two people who couldn't even strum a chord.
Leo Fender and Ted McCarty didn't play guitar. They interviewed guitar players. They wanted to know what they wanted. Ted used to get them together every year in New York City, and Leo had them to the factory. That was normal. Leo had the guy running his factory who had built the PT airplanes during the war, and they had a lot of experience.
Imagine yourself at the wheel of a big, handsome, new Studebaker. Just imagine. Luxury you can afford.
Big news. To come up with a response to the Telecaster, Gibson's Ted McCarty poached designers from the car industry who designed guitars with space-age names such as the Flying V and the Explorer. And in 1954, when Leo Fender produced his next greatest hit, the Stratocaster, he also looked to the sleek, slender lines of a 1950s American automobile.
He based their design on the curves of cars, and it's no coincidence that early Stratocasters were painted with the same colors that were used on cars at the time. Leo was a California guy. He loved seeing the hot rod, and he loved the colors of those cars. And it was all those guys being competitive, grabbing onto this new thing, rock and roll, and all of the modern sort of changes that were happening in U.S. culture at that time.
Sensation all over the country. Elvis Presley.
With the arrival of both television and rock and roll, Fender and Gibson's inventions were now beamed into the homes of ordinary Americans who would catch their favorite guitarists wielding their favorite guitars.
Well, they said you was high class.
Whether it was Elvis's lead guitar player, Scotty Moore, who loved the rich, full-bodied sound of a Gibson, or Buddy Holly, who preferred the clean, twangy sound of a Fender Stratocaster. I'm gonna tell you how it's gonna be. Richard Hawley.
Your standard Les Paul, you know, you could throw it out of a moving vehicle and it'd still pretty much be intact. They are heavy in lots of ways, instruments.
Jim Peterick.
Les Paul is fatter, it's richer. Sustain, and you know, the sustain, like you see in Spinal Tap. You go across to the pub and it'd still be sustaining. I love the Les Pauls for the sustain, really.
Duane Eddy told me a great story about Leo Fender. That Tellys and Strats, that they sound the way they do, it's not because of it was a deliberate policy in terms of sound. It was because Leo was really tight, and he would have constantly be going on to the people who made the pickups, don't use too much wire, it costs too much money. And as a result, as a byproduct, they ended up with these pickups that were really hot because they didn't have too much wire on them, you know. So happy accidents from that era created great sounds.
One guitarist who spotted the potential of producing new and innovative sounds with a Stratocaster was Hank Marvin of The Shadows, Cliff Richard's backing group. Formed in 1958, they proved hugely popular with the British public, thanks to Hank's distinctive playing style, and in particular, his innovative use of a Strat's vibrato bar. This is the lever attached to the bridge of the instrument, which increases the tension of the strings. Here's Hank speaking to the BBC in 2014.
Those guitars in those days were all strung with very heavy strings. The second string was the only one you could really bend, maybe half a tone. With the vibrato bar, I could pull it up another half tone, get the full tone bend. I could put a vibrato on the strings so it sounded more voice-like and made it sing more. I could hit a note and dip the string down slightly under the note or bring it up to the note. A more like a vocal approach. Could give it a good shake. For example, beginning of Man of Mystery. I do a double stop thing at the top and give it a good shake, and it's very dramatic. You know, when I first did that, people loved it. Whoa, what's going on here?
David Hepworth.
Hank Marvin is the guitar hero's guitar hero. So all those guys like Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, and Jeff Beck all went on to inspire generations of very often Americans. They were all inspired by Hank Marvin. And what Hank Marvin had, he seemed to me the first person to intuit this idea that a guitar is not like a normal instrument. You wear it, you don't play it. It turns ordinary people into kind of semi-mythical figures just by putting this thing on.
I'm not entirely sure how comfortable I would feel describing this next individual as a semi-mythical figure. That's because I've played with David Gilmour, the lead guitarist in our band Pink Floyd, for more than five decades.
My dream and ambition was to have a Fender, preferably a Stratocaster. Hank Marvin played one. That was enough for me. I just wanted a Strat.
And there's one Stratocaster, the Black Strat, as David likes to call it, which has featured on just about all our albums, including Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here.
Shine On You Crazy Diamond came out of this guitar. In one way or another, it's probably on most tracks from 1970 through till the middle 80s.
But one of David's most cherished guitars is this one. We don't
need no thoughts control. I have a white 1954 Stratocaster. The serial number is 0001. This guitar was given by Leo Fender with all gold parts to a guy called Rex Gallion. Rex Gallion is the guy who suggested that he sculpt out the body to make it fit easier because a plank of wood just sitting on you has got rough edges. And this guy apparently was the guy who gave him the tip-off of how to make it more comfortable to play and why it's become iconic. One of the nicest guitars I've ever had or played. It's got a beautiful tone. There's really been no improvement on the Stratocaster and on the electric guitar since that guitar came out in 54.
There is perhaps one other guitarist whose name is more synonymous with the Stratocaster. Sorry, David. He was a young American who we supported on a tour of Britain way back in 1967. And his name?
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix, the single greatest player on that instrument.
Music journalist Robert Christgau.
Both his technique and his sonic imagination were not only unsurpassed at the time he came up, but have never been surpassed. I believe most metal guitarists, which is really where the greatest virtuosos of the electric guitar have done their work, none of them are anywhere near as good. I mean, it isn't even close.
Despite dying at the age of 27 in 1970, Jimi Hendrix is still cited as a major influence on guitarists writing and performing today. Guitarists such as Anna Calvi.
The riff that made me want to pick up guitar was probably... Jimi Hendrix had just an incredible sense of phrase and musicality in terms of how you set up a note, how much you bend it, how hard you hit the string. There's so much detail to his playing. It's not just about playing fast, but it's about how you approach your notes, not just about what notes you play. There was a bit that I could never play that went... But that was when I was 12, so I think it's fair enough that it was a bit much. Have you ever been? Have you ever been
to Electric Ladyland? Coming up in the history of music and technology, we hear from the handful of enthusiasts who decided to give Fender and Gibson a run for their money.
So I took a hammer and a screwdriver and I just started banging away madly at chopping out all the wood, and next thing you know, got this whammy bar that can go really sharp.
That's all coming up right after the news. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology, here on the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, and as we heard in the first half, this week we're chopping our way through the history of the electric guitar. So far, we've witnessed the great duel between Fender and Gibson. My bandmate, David Gilmour, picked out some of his favourite Stratocasters. Plus, we heard why Jimi Hendrix is still king of the strings. But none of this would have been possible if the electric guitar had only ever sounded like this. When we all know it should sound like this. And that's only possible thanks to the electric guitar's brother in arms, the amplifier. Oh, yeah. One pioneering musician who spotted the potential of these bulky boxes was the father of Chicago blues. Everything gonna be all right this morning. Play It Loud author Brad Tilinski again.
People talk about Elvis as the king of rock and roll, but Muddy Waters did something almost more important. He more or less created the framework for the rock or the blues band, for the amplified rock or blues band. Muddy had made a reputation in the South for being a great acoustic blues player. But when he left the South and moved to the city of Chicago, he quickly discovered that an acoustic guitar was not going to cut it in this loud, noisy, urban environment. So him and another guitar player, Jimmy Rogers, both started putting pickups on their guitars and plugging them into amplifiers, the bar owners loved it because they could make as much sound as a big band, but they took up less room and there were fewer musicians to pay. And that really is the economic motivation for the music industry to get behind the rock band.
Early guitar amps were often just modified public address systems. But by the late 40s, technicians such as Leo Fender started designing amps specifically for the electric guitar. Today, there are hundreds of different makes and models which help players produce their own unique sound. And speak to any guitarist, it's more than likely they'll tell you they have a lot of amps.
I've got a lot of amps.
Guitarist Richard Hawley.
I use in the studio WEM Dominators. I've got a pair of those in stereo and I call it the double whammy. But I've got really old ones as well, Vibraluxes and Tremoluxes from the 60s and 50s, the Tweed ones that are fabulous amps. There's a mate of mine called Andy Drinko from Sheffield and he makes amps out of old converted screen projectors, you know, the old cinema projectors. I've got one of his and that's a fabulous amp as well.
But there is one particular black box which has come to define the sound of rock music. And it was created in a music shop in London just over 50 years ago by Jim Marshall, who was soon dubbed the father of loud.
I hated being interrupted. I hated being shouted at by yobbos. And it just so happened around that time Jim Marshall opened a music shop and he had a chip on his shoulder about something and we decided to join together and make the loudest amplifiers known to man so that nobody could ever interrupt me ever again.
Guitarist Pete Townshend of The Who talking to the BBC in 2014. Young musicians such as Townshend gathered in Jim's shop looking for help to make their guitars sound as loud as possible.
For me, when I think about Jim's shop, it was a meeting place, a place to go with ideas where you would know you would get listened to. You know, some of my ideas, the guys in my band wouldn't listen to them.
At the present moment in time, we're stood in our museum, which has got a selection of over 300 amplifiers, from the original number one through to amplifiers made yesterday, if you like.
It's only a snapshot. This is Phil Wells of Marshall Amps.
Over 700. So in 66,
a far cry from Jim's small shop in West London, the Marshall Amps headquarters are now based in Milton Keynes, some 50 miles north of London, and employ over 150 people.
Number one is in the middle of the museum in its own glass case because of obvious reasons. It's only the chassis. There is no wooden box. The reason it's like that is originally it was made, obviously, as a prototype, but it was sold. It was sold for a weekend. A gentleman came in the shop, was desperate to have an amplifier for the weekend, so Jim sold it him on the understanding he would bring it back. It hasn't actually been plugged in for nearly 30 years. It's now to the point we're not going to plug it in because of what may happen to it. As far as that and number one and the amplifiers for the first 3 or 4 years, they were 30, 35 watts. Jim, he was getting people going into the shop, guitarists such as Page, Pete Townshend and Hendrix, moaning that it wasn't enough.
As the wattage of the amps increased, it didn't just make the guitar louder. It began to fundamentally alter its sound and the way it was played. Pete Townshend again.
I suddenly realised, as did a number of other players around the time, Jeff Beck, Dave Davis, Jimmy Page, we were all stumbling on distortion. As these amplifiers got bigger and bigger, distortion creating a long, sinewy sound from the guitar, rather than a ding. To be fluid, you had to go. So the guitar was a staccato instrument, but with sustain, it became like a voice, like a violin.
The Marshall amp helped give the electric guitar a new, louder voice. And soon the Marshall stack would provide the onstage backdrop to rock and roll for decades to come. These days, many amps come with inbuilt effects, such as reverb and delay. But a lot of guitarists prefer to use what's called a pedal box. This sits on the stage floor and contains innumerable effects, which when tapped with the player's foot, changes the sounds coming out of the guitar. To find out more about guitar effects, I enlisted the help of Lee Harris from my band, Sourceful of Secrets.
Within Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, we focus solely on all of the material Pink Floyd produced before Dark Side of the Moon. When they recorded these albums, there was nothing like there is available now. So if they were using a delay pedal, for instance, it would probably go up to about a third of a second of delay. Now you can get up to about probably 10 seconds of delay. I have about 8 different pedals with varying tones that reproduce the sounds from the albums. Actually, the track A Sourceful of Secrets, I'll just dial it up on here. David would take a slide and rub it on the string and get this sound. And if I go on a little bit, there's a song we do called Fearless that has a little bit of delay on to get a ethereal sound. I don't actually employ this in the show, but it's probably a bit more reminiscent of what David Gilmour did on later albums, but it is basically just a digital delay feeding back quite a few times, and you can play along with it. If I just play it once, see, you've got the delay coming back, and if you keep playing,
as rock and roll was in full swing in the late 60s, an interesting thing happened to the electric guitar. Japanese companies started flooding the US market with cheap models. Meanwhile, Leo Fender sold up to the company CBS. And with these developments came a decline in quality. Dismayed by these turn of events, a handful of enthusiasts decided to take matters into their own hands.
One of the most profound examples of this is Eddie Van Halen. This young 16-year-old kid in California just decided that he couldn't stand these new guitars that he bought. So he started taking pieces from older guitars, like building entirely new instruments out of it. And all of a sudden, everybody got this idea that the guitar was no longer the sacred thing built by Les Paul or Ted McCarty or Leo Fender. Yeah, you may have all you want, baby,
but I got something you need. In 1975, Van Halen constructed his first Frankenstrat, replacing a Gibson's wood body and neck with bits from an old boogie board. In the same year, a 19-year-old guitar maker, Paul Reed Smith, sold his first guitar to hard rocker Ted Nugent. Only a few years earlier, Smith had been working as a repairman when he spotted something interesting.
I once went to the patent office, and at the time, you didn't go online. You had to physically go through them in stacks, and I kept running across two names over and over again of products that I'd seen on my repair bench, and they were either from a guy named Leo Fender or Ted McCarty. I didn't know who Ted McCarty was, but I was fascinated by that.
Today, PRS Guitars are one of the most respected guitar makers in the world. But Paul didn't get his big break until 1980, when Mexican-American guitarist Carlos Santana brought a PRS guitar.
Carlos Santana playing a PRS was a big deal. And I remember Carlos Santana, I had an order from him. He calls me up, and I'm gluing the body together. And he goes, "It's going to stay in tune, right, Paul?" I went, "Oh, yeah, no problem." I had a busy month doing everything I could possibly do to that tremolo system to get it to stay in tune. Musicians are looking for a tool to make their living on. And if they're using one of these, they've gone through an awful lot of test trials with other tools, and I found that fascinating, what they were using. You know, if there's a rack of guitars at a rock concert,
and one of them's a PRS, and the guy doesn't go for the PRS, and I haven't done my job.
In the mid-80s, Steve Vai, a heavy rock and metal guitarist, felt the instrument was ready for its next evolutionary step. Steve was inspired by one of rock's most experimental characters.
I am gross and perverted. I
worked for Frank Zappa. He'd explore things to their depth, in a sense. Anything, including gear. He had a little workshop underneath the studio, and he would have all these elements put into the guitar, like parametric EQs, various kinds of effects built into the guitar. So I was able to see he would stretch things.
In 1985, Steve started working with the Japanese company Ibanez on a guitar he christened the Gem.
I decided to design a guitar that kind of fit my weird idiosyncrasies. Simple things that just weren't available. I mean, if you look at my guitar, it's over here. It's a Gem, and it's the guitar that I designed 35 years ago. You see how the cutaway here is perfect for my hand. So I have no problem reaching high and playing those beautiful singing high notes, you know. The big innovation was, at the time, the whammy bar was evolving. And this guy, Floyd Rose, developed this system that allowed you to go mad on the whammy bar without it going out of tune. I wanted to go higher, and I couldn't understand why. So I just looked at what was obstructing the ability for the whammy bar to go to the stratosphere higher. And it was just the wood at the base of the bar would just stop it from going. So I took a hammer and a screwdriver, and I just started banging away madly at chopping out all the wood. And next thing you know, got this whammy bar that can go really sharp. You hear that? I did want to put something on the guitar that I knew nobody would really consider taking, and that's the handle, the monkey grip, which was so quirky. I originally did it so, like, when we were doing videos and stuff, I could hold onto the guitar and swing it around, you know? But it kind of turned into the identity of the Gem.
Whatever it is about an electric guitar, whether it's the aesthetic, the sound, the rich history, there are few other instruments which make collectors out of its players.
So these are some of my favorites through the years. Some are valuable, some are very valuable, some are valuable just to me. Very early Rickenbacker.
This is Jim Peterick at his home in Chicago. Jim's the founding member of the Ides of March and Survivor, and his home doubles up as a sort of private museum to the history of the instrument.
This is one of my most valuable guitars, 1958 Les Paul Custom 3, mint condition, probably is worth about 150 to 250 grand, depending on the day. This is, I played the song Vehicle, which was my first hit record in 1970 by the Ides of March, which had the signature line, I'm the friendly stranger in the black sedan, won't you hop inside my car? I'm your vehicle, baby.
Well, I'm the friendly stranger in the black sedan, won't you hop inside my car?
You gotta remember that one. This is the guitar that played that song. You can see the belt wear on the back. Those were the days of big buckles and big hairdos and big egos. But it's a great guitar, and I would never part with that guitar. It'll probably be buried with me.
But the one guitar missing from Jim's collection just happens to be the one he wrote his biggest hit single on, penned while speaking on the phone to the director and star of Rocky III, Sylvester Stallone.
I want you to write the theme song for a generation. You think you can help me out? I said, no problem. I want something with a pulse. And I had my Les Paul around my neck, and I just was catching the feeling. I just started going, digga, 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 digga. Real pulsing in it. Bump, 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 bump. And I was trying to time the chords with the punches. Bump, bump, bump. And man, the whole thing just unfolded. And who knew that in the year 2000, whatever this is, it would still be around, man, and still making a difference. And that's the biggest reward any songwriter could have. That was stolen. My iconic 81 Les Paul White. If anybody knows where the whereabouts, I won't ask any questions. I want it back.
By By the 1980s, in its short life, the electric guitar had already been harnessed to produce a myriad of different styles and sounds. And while the likes of Jim Peterick and Steve Vai enjoyed success, with their big hair, big buckles and a big sound to match, there was a band from Boston who had other ideas for the instrument.
Stop!
The Pixies took a nod from punk and surf rock, and their sound was scored with sparse, jarring lead lines. Eventually, they would pave the way for the 1990s grunge scene, which saw guitar bands such as Nirvana and Pearl Jam sell millions of albums. But in their early days, the Pixies struggled to win over audiences. Here's lead guitarist Joey Santiago.
When we started playing live in Boston, we had a lot of this perplexed look. No one was really clapping or anything. They would just go, "What the heck is this?" It kind of inspired us to go, "You got to get this. You have to get it because we love it." The main purpose of what I do with the guitar is definitely minimum. I just take one word, "Oh, dead, okay." And then I thought about the shower scene, the Psycho. So I did that. I did my version of it. Sometimes I'm really simple just to kind of be a wise guy. You know, like, look, you really don't have to play this many notes. One note can do it.
Now, listening to this documentary, you might have noticed one thing. That the story of this instrument is a very male one. Why? Music writer David Hepworth has a theory.
Here's the thing that guys like more than anything in the world, more than sex, more than money. They love equipment. I've had many musicians say this to me. That's what gets them up in the morning. So the strongest relationship in music is not between the musicians and the audience. It's between the musicians and their equipment.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time...
Male musicians might love their equipment, but a quick look at the history books suggests women were the pioneers of this instrument. Richard Hawley.
If you think about the early exponents of lead guitar, you've got Maybelle Carter, who played single note lead lines, and you got Sister Rosetta Tharpe as well.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
It has become largely a male thing, but the concept, you could argue, was largely invented by women, not men.
If there has been a male dominance since those early days, times are changing.
The world is changing. The world of guitar playing is changing, and I think for the better. The truth is, over the last couple of years, women are responsible for almost 50% of the sales of guitars, which is a radical shift from where it was 10 years ago.
One guitarist leading this charge is St. Vincent.
I was really honestly astounded when I drew a little sketch and then they said, "Okay, we'll make this. We think this is really interesting. Let's pursue this."
In 2016, St. Vincent teamed up with the boutique guitar makers Ernie Ball Music Man to create a series of female-friendly guitars.
I think the general idea was to make a guitar kind of from the ground up, where you just take things and distill them down to their most basic forms.
The St. Vincent Signature series is light with a slim, tapered waist to suit a female player.
After playing guitar for 20 years and loving it so passionately that I had a tool that was made specifically with me in mind. It was just phenomenal. I was like a kid in a candy store.
For guitarist Anna Calvi, there's one simple reason why she welcomes this latest development.
I like playing Telecasters, but they're very heavy. I'm 5'2" and slight. And so sometimes when I'm thrusting my guitar in the air, having to do it every night, it can be damaging for my back. I think I weighed my guitar and I think it was like a stone. So that's more than an eighth of my body weight. If I was a man, open my body. I think a lot of the really interesting guitarists now are female. And I think part of that is because they don't have the same canon of history of seeing so many women go on stage and do the same blues riff. If I was a man, open my body. In terms of seeing the guitar as some kind of phallic extension, which I know a lot of male guitarists do, I mean, for me, a guitar looks and feels like a woman. I mean, if you look at the shape, it has a waist and it has hips. It feels distinctly female in the sense of female being powerful and able to withstand whatever you throw at it.
Over the course of its almost 100-year history, the electric guitar has been on an incredible journey. Arguably, there's no other piece of music technology that's had such an impact on global popular culture. But while no one can deny its rich history, many are unsure of its future. Guitar sales in America have declined in recent years, and companies have struggled. In May 2018, Gibson filed for bankruptcy.
I don't know if the guitar has a future. It would be very easy for me, probably in my benefit, to rah-rah it. But I think music and instruments change with technology. And right now, the way I hear, especially hip-hop, which is the predominant form of pop music these days, there are tones involved in that music, sub-basses, and that guitar just doesn't get at.
It's what I call snap-to-grid music. It's made digitally, which means it's made the way your taxes are done. It's not people making noises into the air. It's people sending signals down wires. And that's not to say you can't make brilliant records. Pop music has always been about technology. But it's difficult to harness the guitar into the way records are made nowadays.
But that's fine, because there's still this huge subculture in metal. I see it all the time. I get sent, you know, YouTube links of these players, and I'm just like, whoa, they've really evolved the craft. I mean, far beyond what I was doing. The guitar is still alive and well and strong and thriving in communities of people that are just really, really fans of it. They love it. And within the pop culture, it may emerge again as a prominent instrument, but it will be presented in a different way. As different as Chuck Berry and Jimi Hendrix, and Jimi Hendrix as Eddie Van Halen, it'll just evolve into something different.
Whatever the future holds for the electric guitar, for the likes of Richard Hawley, this is an instrument that transcends the whims of fashion.
I feel naked. I haven't got a guitar near me. There's something that there's a nakedness. I don't feel complete. I feel complete when I'm holding a guitar. It's not just a musical instrument that you can create something on and it can amuse you and stop you getting bored or even lonely. It's been my friend and it's accompanied me through all the events of my life pretty much since being a kid. So I feel very, very odd without it.
Coming up next time, the Hammond organ.
You open the back, you look at the guts, that thing is... It's intriguing, all that stuff is in there.
There were some who felt this was the devil's instrument.
He used to plunge knives into the gaps between the keys at certain dramatic moments in solo.
But for now, thanks for listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The programme was mixed by James Beard and produced by Craig Smith. The editor is Jasper Corbett. It was made in association with the Open University.